Hi, everyone. Welcome to Dishing with Digest. I'm Stephanie Sloan, editorial director, here with Mara Levinsky, senior editor.
Hi, everyone.
Well, Mara, February sweeps are upon us, and the shows have some big story planned. So first of all, in days, John is going to get a blast from the past, as will Ben when his sister Jordan, played by Chrishell Hartley, returns to town. On B&B, Hope will get to hold her baby, who, as we know, she thinks is dead, but has actually been adopted by Steffi.
Now, on General Hospital, Laura is going to grow more suspicious of Kevin's behavior. Anna and Finn will look into a piece of her past with Robert Scorpio's help. And Sonny will have to make some big decisions about his ailing father, Mike. And on Y&R, Nick will finally learn the full truth about JT's death, and Kane will try to make amends for his dalliance with Victoria.
Well, of course, we can also expect some big Valentine's Day moments. Will and Sunny fans will want to tune into Days. Spoiler alert. Also look for a Ted and Hope kiss. And on B&B, Thorne will drop a bomb on Katie. So speaking of B&B, let's go back to the story with Hope. We just discovered for certain that her baby lived and that her child, who she named Beth, will now be raised by Steffi. Now, this is not a new story for Daytime. We saw it with Bianca and Babe on All My Children, Sammy and Nicole with Sydney on Days, and we're seeing it now with Baby Wiley on GH. But it really struck me that this doesn't seem like a B&B type of story. You know, even having Hope cry for as long as she has, and trust when I say that Annika Noel has been doing such a fantastic job, but it almost feels out of place on this soap, which I feel tries to stay out of that really heavy lane of melodrama.
Yeah, maybe it's because it's a half-hour show and it has fewer characters on in a given day, but it has seemed very heavy on the anguish. And I can't really think of the last time on B&B where we saw a character cry this many days in a row.
Me neither. And yet, if she had just gotten over it in a day or two, that certainly wouldn't have felt right either. You know, I appreciate that the show has taken its time with showing her grief, but I can't lie that it's been a little hard to watch. I don't know that I can be sucked into that kind of emotion when I have the show on, like, here at the office.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I appreciate on General Hospital that Michael and Willow are both in grief counseling, but I also appreciate that the grief counseling sessions themselves are not on camera so much. You know, to me, that's a good compromise between suggesting that one can get over something as devastating as, like, the loss of a child in a couple of days or weeks or even months. But also it works for me to know that they're doing that when I'm not seeing them. Like, I don't need to be in on the sessions.
Right.
I do tend to like therapy sessions on soaps, by the way. I wish we got to see more of Alexis's therapy that started. But I do think that, you know, the crying every day does not escape as television make.
You know, and to that point, even though I'm sitting here saying, like, oh, it's kind of hard to get through, I do like that they've had Hope, you know, cry and show her emotions through this. There is nothing I like less than a stoic reaction to death. I just think it is so not real life. I don't know anyone who hasn't cried when they lost someone close to them, and it is just really not my favorite choice.
Yeah, I've seen some rough non-reactions to deaths on soaps in my day. You know, it just makes me feel... like, I wish they had time for another take. That's, like, the nicest thing I can say.
But, you know, sometimes I feel it's the actor's choice. Like, oh, my character is going to respond this way. And I'm assuming as part of a bigger narrative that the show is telling. But not a big fan of that. I am also not a huge fan of denial.
I was just going to say that I love the point you made. I believe it was after Kiki's death on GH that people are like, no, it can't be. You were like, why not? You know, certainly I've experienced losses that seem surreal, but I was able to simultaneously feel like they were surreal and intellectually understand, you know, that the thing, that the person or being that I love is no longer here. Hey, Steph. Do you like it when people scream at dead bodies to wake up?
I think you know the answer to that. I mean, I guess I just expect soaps to mirror real life in storylines where the situations are all too real. I'm not going to judge a possession story too hard or a back from the dead, you know, the things that we don't see every day in real life. But when it's something that viewers have experienced personally, I just like to see care taken with the execution.
I think one of the reasons that BJ's death on GH will always be held up as soap excellence is because Jackie Zeman, Christina Wagner, and Brad Mall delivered 100% heart-wrenching performances. You know, if they had struck false notes or no notes, it would have undercut the impact of that storyline considerably.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a story that whenever we do the greatest soap moments, the greatest soap storylines, the greatest soap deaths, you know, anything, the greatest soap performances, we always go back to that story.
Yeah, they channeled something so human. And I think that's really what we're talking about, ultimately.
That's what I want to see. That's why we watch soaps.
Yeah.
Well, on a GH note, our guest today is James Patrick Stewart, better known in Port Charles as Valentine Cassadine. So let's get him on the phone and see what he has to say about his character and his recent trip to Nashville. Hi, James.
Hi.
How are you today? Well, you're here with Steph and with Mara.
Hi, Steph and Mara. Good to talk to you.
You too.
You too. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, you just got back from Graceland. Tell us all about it.
Isn't that something? That was that. I mean, I would love everybody to get a chance to go. I think by the time Elvis had gone, you know, I was fairly young, and so my first impression of him was at the tail end of his life. Getting a chance to go to Graceland and see his house and sort of feel his spirit in it and see footage of him as a young man and see all the artifacts. It was really exciting. It really, really was. And I can't recommend it heartily enough. The jungle room in the back of his house, I had no idea that he had actually recorded three albums in his own house. And, you know, the carpeted kitchen, it had such incredible personality.
And design inspiration for you and your wife.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. No, she won't let me carpet the kitchen.
I've actually never heard of that.
I know. What's weird is you talk to somebody in the kitchen, it just doesn't feel right. It feels awkward because the acoustics, it doesn't feel like a kitchen. It just feels like a recording studio. Yeah.
Interesting.
But I absolutely loved it. And, you know, the people were unbelievably receptive. We had a huge turnout for the convention, for the event. And they couldn't have been more accommodating. I mean, they were just, you know, it was great.
Well,
fun.
Obviously, James, you had told me about what a like inspiration Rick Springfield was to you as a guitarist.
Mm-hmm.
So I was stalking your Instagram, waiting for the picture of the two of you, and I was so delighted that you did get to meet. So tell us all about that.
Yeah, well, it's funny that actually I've explained that to Frank Valentini, and his eyebrow went up. He's like, it seems sort of incongruous, right? It's sort of like for me to go around talking about Rick Springfield. But the truth is that when I was 13 years old, I had a girlfriend who was a fan, and I had surprised her with two Rick Springfield tickets, and my mom had paid for them with her Visa card. And I broke up with the girl just a week before the concert, so I ended up going solo. And I didn't really know his stuff. I mean, I think Jesse's Girl was number one that week or whatever. And so it was sort of, I kind of knew what the song was. But what I wasn't expecting, and having grown up in the music industry, I'd seen plenty of guys like, you know, Sean Cassidy and whatnot. You come out, you sing, and then when it's time for the guitar solo, you let somebody a little bit more proficient take over. And what blew me away was Rick did his own solo. He was pretty much his own lead guitar player, and that was cool to me. That was, you know, for my young 13-year-old self, it was like seeing Jimi Hendrix. It was really, it was exciting to watch how musical he was. And you know, the songs obviously were hits and catchy. And it didn't hurt that I was 13 and I watched his influence on the young ladies. And I was like, I got to get a guitar, you know? So I went home and I taught myself Jesse's Girl and I bought his record and I taught myself, I went up, moved on to Love Is All Right Tonight and, you know, Everybody's Girl. And I just found myself learning all these songs, and that's how I learned to play guitar. Even though my father is an extremely proficient guitar player, he could never get me to pick it up.
It was but Rick Springfield did.
It,
so were you like, were you nervous
cool.
to meet him? Did you embarrass yourself at all?
I don't know that I was nervous, although I was at the side of the stage with Finola, with Wes, and with Laura. And you know, he looked right at me and there was that moment of like, holy crap, there I'm 13, 14 all over again. And Rick Springfield is looking right at me. It was really freaking cool is what it was. And, you know, Finola knew him. I worked together. So she was the one who did the intros and we talked briefly. We talked a little bit about music. We talked about the fact that I'd been at the show in, you know, 1981 at the Universal Amphitheater, which of course I didn't really impress him much because he was there too.
And probably had a better view.
Yeah, he had a much better seat than I had. And, And then we talked about the Malibu fires and the fact that, you know, at his age, and we didn't talk about his age, but he's no spring chicken. He's doing 100 shows a year. And I think, you know, it was really neat. It was neat to finally get a chance to meet him. You know, and all my friends from high school, they commented on the post too. They knew that it was going to happen one day. It took a little longer than they thought, but they knew it was going to happen one day.
That's so cool.
And then I went home and, you know, I've been recording this album, the Apple Tree, and I came home and a full day that I should have been working on it was spent playing Rick Springfield.
It's all part of the creative process.
Inspiration.
It was. And there's that part of me. It's like, I can't possibly put a Rick Springfield cover on. What are you kidding? But we'll see. We'll see what happens. There's a call in to one of his people.
Well, as you mentioned, you did grow up in the music industry. Your father, Chad Stewart, was in the group Chad and Jeremy. Mm-hmm. So first of all, tell us what that was even like. And were you even aware sort of what your dad did?
Yeah, I was aware, but much like everything else in life, you know, familiarity, I don't know if it bred contempt, but I wasn't all that impressed by it. But when I was very young, Chad and Jeremy had the same publicist as the Beatles. His name is Derek Taylor. And so the sort of the two companies, Chad and Jeremy and Apple, the Beatles company, they did a lot of business together. And so oftentimes I would be at Derek's house playing with his daughter, Lucy, and there on the couch sitting next to me was George Harrison in his full long hair, long beard. You know, I knew who the Beatles were, so I was kind of impressed with all the celebrities my father knew. But my father being a celebrity, he didn't feel like a celebrity. He was just my dad, you know. And Jeremy Clyde would always bring people. I think there was a time that Jeremy was dating Lauren Bacall, and you know, so there were sort of celebrities around. But it was just normal to me. It was just, and my father coached my soccer team, so it was just like he was just my dad, you know. It was just cool when he met celebrities because they were always so happy to meet him. Like Glenn Campbell had worked as a session musician for Chad and Jeremy a couple of times. And so when we were finally on the Tonight Show and Glenn saw him, Glenn sort of dropped everything to run over to say hello to my father. And I knew who he was. I mean, Rhinestone Cowboy was a hit when I was a kid. And it was neat that way, you know, but that's about all I can say about that. It was just a cool way to meet celebrities.
Well, just so you know, I am the hugest Beatles fan. So I have the dopiest grin on my face, just even listening to these stories. I mean, it sounds incredible.
Yeah, my father's Rick Springfield was Paul McCartney. You know, he was right. Really, even, you know, even to this day, if when Paul McCartney recorded with a mandolin, my dad went out and bought a mandolin.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, I remember when he first got the mandolin, you know, and he played the three songs, the three chords that Paul plays in Everybody's Gonna Dance Tonight. Just like a kid, my dad plays the three chords and he goes, "My God, it's so simple." He goes, "Why didn't I think of that?" Yes, the Apple Tree album. The Apple Tree album is something that has been a long time coming. My father, being a composer and a rocker and a producer and a writer, you know, he raised me as a drummer, basically. And my father also raised my brother as a bass player. So we were supposed to be the rhythm section. And after Jeremy was gone, we were supposed to carry the mantle. And the three of us would ride off into the sunset playing music. And, life is, it's what happens while you're busy making other plans. My brother went into science and I went into something way more secure, like television. Whenever I visit him on Thanksgiving and Christmas, he'd always be like, you know, "Where's the album? You know, where's the album? You should really put the album out." And, you know, for whatever reason, this Thanksgiving, my father, you know, this year, my father hung up his dancing shoes and he retired. He doesn't tour anymore. And there was just a sort of a deep, deep, deep resonance in me when I saw him. I was just like, you know, I think now is the time because I'm not going to have forever to do this. So I turned around and I talked to some people and all of a sudden, a lot of musician friends of mine were just like, "How can we help? How can we help?" Christine Wu from the Nurses Ball last year was like saying, "You just let me know, and we'll all be there." And Christine and I have already put just a phenomenal song together, and we're working on another one to pitch for if they're going to have another Nurses Ball or if they'll have me. You know, I've got another one to pitch to them, and all of these will end up on the album. We've got about 8 songs done. They're not mixed, but they certainly will be. I'm hoping to have 10, perhaps even 11 by April, and then we'll release it in conjunction with the Nurse's Ball. So it'll be available on iTunes and Spotify and all those things, and it's called The Apple Tree. And I'm really, really proud of it.
I'm so excited to hear it, and I'm also wondering, James, if there's any chance that, you know, you could hook your girl up with a complimentary copy over here.
Of course.
All right. Sweet.
I'll even sign it for it. And there'll be a couple of Chad and Jeremy tunes on there too. What's really, really cool is getting a chance to record some of the Chad and Jeremy stuff that isn't necessarily the stuff that made it to the top 10. But growing up, I would hear my father play them, and I just thought that's just the greatest. I just love that song. There's a song on one of his last albums that's called Rest in Peace, and it's just devastating. And I actually reached out to Jeremy if he'd be willing to sing on it with me. He said anytime. He said,
wow.
I'd be happy to come climb your tree.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's really cool.
So thanks for asking.
Oh, yeah, of course. We can't wait to hear it. So let's take a little walk back to the start of your daytime career. Tell us how you came to join All My Children.
Yeah.
You bastard.
Yeah. What?
I'm referring to you as Will, really, when I say that, but he was a no good Nick.
I thought I missed something. Yes, he was a bastard. And the funny thing is that he was a bastard for about 6 months. And what I love is that all these years later, people still come up to me and talk about how great that ride was, that 6 months. It really was a moment where the gloves really came off. But to begin with, I was struggling in Hollywood. I was going to class with a couple of unknown punks, Benicio del Toro and Mark Ruffalo. And when I got the audition for the soap, I remember one of the things I remember about it was there was an earthquake during the read, and the casting director got on the desk, but I didn't stop reading.
That's commitment.
And I think that might have led to why I was flown to New York to read with Katie McClain. And that was an exciting day because I don't think I'd ever been to New York. And I got a chance to run around and have a real New York pizza and stuff like that. And by the time I got home, they said, you got 3 days to pack to get back to New York. And I was so green. If you show me any video of those first few episodes, it makes my toes curl to the point where I almost need medical attention because I was so nervous and I was so obsessed with all the wrong things. And Michael Knight, God bless him, really took me under his wing. And he really showed me the ropes. And, he's become a lifelong friend, still is. He's actually my youngest son, Colin. And he just sort of showed me how to do it. And the irony was, by the time I, figured out what's what, Felicia, the executive producer, came down to my dressing room, which is probably why all of us always, have the fear of God put into us when they say, please report to Frank. It's sort of like, some sort of stress disorder. You're certainly getting fired. But, she was like, the bad news is we're going to let you ride into the sunset. The good news is we're going to have give you a hell of a send off. And Will's, the lead up to Will's death was just a barrel of monkeys. It was a ton of fun. It really was. I still have a poster on the dressing room signed by everybody because there were so many suspects in his murder. Kelly Ripa was a suspect.
Yep.
They're all suspects.
It was one of the best crafted, mysteries. I think it's still held up or held in that regard. Photo that you're talking about with everyone in the trench coats, that's iconic.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. I have it on my dressing room door in General Hospital. And I must say that years later, Agnes Nixon, the last time I ever got a chance to talk to her, I ran into her and she said the same thing. She said that was one of my favorite storylines that I've done in a long time. She says, I'm sorry for the way it had to end, but, I really do appreciate you being so gracious about it because it worked great. So that was a nice way. That was a nice exchange. Yeah.
Now, I know that you have been friends for a long, long while with Mr. Ricky Paul Golden, who was on Another World when you were on All My Children, and later, many years later, played Michael Knight's brother on All My Children. But you had me in such hysterics talking to me about your friendship with Ricky Golden. I need more. How did you meet the guy? How did you become friends? And who, I know you guys are still tight.
Yes, I loved both of those guys. So when they became brothers on the show, that was ironic because they'd been two of my best friends for, you know, over a decade when that happened. And Ricky and I, oh my God, Ricky is a great friend. If you're lucky enough to be his friend, he's not just a good friend, he's a great friend because he is so loyal, so intensely loyal. He shows up for his friends. I have more stories than I could possibly tell you, but I will tell you this. When I first met him, he had come to New York to do Another World, and he had heard my name, and because somebody said, "Oh, you should go meet James Patrick," and I had just broken up with my girlfriend, so he comes over and he immediately takes over my apartment. He's just like, he goes, "Can I open these drapes? You know, this bed looks like it needs to be made," and he just completely took over the place, and in retrospect. He admits to me, he says, "Oh, I knew what you were going through, and I wasn't gonna tolerate it." And he ends up just like the second time I'd even met him, he invites me on a personal appearance in Milwaukee. We go to an appearance for 3 days, we're bowling, and he just snapped me right out of my funk. And you know, years later when he broke up with his fiance Yasmin Bleef, I did the same for him. You know, I had him stay at my house. My dog fell in love with him, would no longer sleep with me, only slept with Ricky, just loved Ricky. Would do things like I would get a TV show. I was working with Nathan Lane one time on an NBC show called Encore Encore, and I came backstage after the first episode, and he had set up an entire setup of caviar with all the accoutrements on my coffee table, with a note saying "break a leg," and he didn't even bother to stay to say hello. He just took off. He was like this. This weird elf.
It's amazing.
You know, and we've had money, we've been broke, and one of the things we've always done is we've just always been together. You know, he loves that I'll fly across the country to see him if he's got something to show me, and vice versa. You know, good friend, good friend.
Now, you've had children for a lot longer than him. But has it been sweet to see him become a dad as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it just goes to show the actual action of taking care of that child. I think it's far beyond the genetic part of the equation. I think having to show up for something like that day in and day out totally changes you. Totally changes you. It's made him. He was already a great person, but there's a sort of an authenticity that now resonates beyond what he was now that he's a father. And he adores those children. And what he does to decorate that house on Halloween is just classic Ricky, you know. And his Christmases are something out of a movie. And I'm really impressed with him. I'm very impressed with him. I was sad when All My Children was canceled, as just like everybody. I mean, we all felt a huge disturbance in the force, and I mean, the fans must have been devastated. And watching him go through the transition was rough. But I did also know that he was going to fall squarely on his feet sooner or later, and he definitely has. I mean, the life he has for himself in New York is the envy of millions. You know, he and Greta have a terrific apartment business, multiple businesses that they work, and two beautiful, beautiful children. Yeah. Yeah, thanks for asking. I love those guys.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned Katie McLean, and now you're working at General Hospital with her husband, John Lindstrom. You know, what is it like for you to sort of just have all these connections that kind of come back around in this business?
I know it's a small world. I think, you know, once you prove that you can do the work, you know, then everybody gets hired and rehired. And by the time we get to one soap opera left, all of a sudden the guys who the best that Frank can get have been made available. And the one thing about John, I will say, is that I knew who he was, and I was sort of like, by the time I showed up, he was playing Santa Claus occasionally, you know, and I was like, oh, it's come to that, has it? And then we did the scene with Jeannie in the hallway in the hospital, and he was just stunning. I mean, not only that, he was well-trained. His articulation was on point. I mean, everything about him was just really polished. And I thought, oh, I get it. Now I understand. You know, now I understand why he's still around and why he's, why he's got the name.
Jeannie Francis is someone who overlapped from All My Children to General Hospital. And now, man, that Laura does not like Valentine, and with good reason.
No, knowing each other as well as we know. In fact, I've known Finola and I've known Jeannie almost as long as I've, you know, known anybody on that show. And having that history really helps because you're willing to take risks. Jeannie was on All My Children briefly as a Sarah or something.
Sarah
Connor. I can't remember what the character's name was.
You nailed it.
Sarah Connor. Why Sierra Connor? Isn't that what Arnold Schwarzenegger used to say? Sierra Connor, where is Sierra Connor? So I never understood that. I never understood that name. Yeah, but I do remember that she was dating Jean Leclerc on the show, and I remember getting a chance to apple pie her bed. I think I've told you that story. I got a chance to shortcut her bed.
You got to tell us again. It's so delightful.
Yeah, I've never heard it.
Yeah. She and Jean Leclerc, we would block in the morning, we would rehearse in the afternoon, and then we would actually film the show in the evening. And they had blocked, rehearsed, and they were filming, and they were supposed to be naked, so they're all in their bodysuits. It was a very intimate moment. But what they didn't know is that between their dress rehearsal and the shooting, that I had short sheeted their bed, and I was waiting in the lobby of All My Children on 66th Street, watching the monitor with a cab running. And it was just absolutely, it could not have gone better. It was all on tape. And sure enough, Jeannie was the first person to spot it because she was supposed to get under the covers to cover herself. And she couldn't. It was awesome.
And
I jumped in the cab and took off before anybody could figure out who'd done it.
Smart.
Yeah.
Smart.
And then today, when she came back from her sort of momentary missingness this year, you know, we were doing a scene on the dock and there was not supposed to be a slap, but I watched her get so worked up and I said, Jeannie, I know you want to hit me. Feel free. She goes, no, I can't. I said, listen, you're not going to hurt me. Hit me. And so sure enough, during the filming, she slowed me so hard. It was phenomenal. But the next thing you know, you get after the scene, you go, Janice, please report to Frank's office.
Uh-oh.
So I go up there and he's like, what the hell was that? I go, my fault. I should have told you. He goes, your face is all pink. What are we supposed to do with you now?
You do a good Frank.
Oh my gosh, Frank's amazing. He's a character. I mean, love him absolutely, but I would never want to call Frank Valentini ever. Yeah.
So lesson learned: don't give slap approval to Jeannie without running it by the boss.
Exactly. I should at least let them know it's coming. Right? Yeah.
Well, you had a long period in between your two daytime gigs, where you certainly racked up an impressive list of credits.
You were everywhere.
I mean, I feel like Mar and I were like checking out your IMDb just to see, you know, where to even go with it,
yeah,
because
exactly.
There were so many things.
Yeah. Do you know the thing I'm the most proud of, though? The thing that somebody pointed this out to me. I think the thing I'm the most proud of is if you look at that, you'll notice that there's a lot of recurring. There's a lot of being invited back. And I think that the heroes that I watched early on in my career, guys like Martin Sheen and John Lithgow and guys like this who were just really decent, cool people who knew their lines, never, ever complained and were just really, really, you know, proud of their work. You know, I think that I tried to follow that. I tried to emulate that to the best that I could, you know. And I think that that's why I got invited back so many times. You know, a single guest appearance would turn into either a recurring or a series regular. And that's the thing I'm the most proud of, you know. And I think that hopefully, Frank, we don't know each other terribly well, but I think one thing he does know about me is that I'm there to be part of the solution. I'm not there to complain. I'm there to help the show get across the finish line at the end of the day and be invited back tomorrow, you know. And I think that on some level he respects that. And I think that's why I'm still there, even when I was only supposed to be there for 10 days.
Well, to that point, I think certainly, you know, how we met Valentine, a little, shotgun moment on Cassadine Island comes to mind. He did not seem slated to be long-lasting, and yet here we are several years down the line. So obviously you didn't think going in that this was going to be the case. What keeps you wanting to stay there and keep tackling Valentine?
I do so many reasons, you know, and I think it was a shift in perception because at the time, you know, I was busy trying to land the big nighttime thing. And I was like, I don't, what? No, soap opera is behind me, blah, 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 blah. I don't do that. Da, da, da. And the shift in perception was, I think, A, I love the danger. B, I love the people. I love the challenge. I take it as seriously as anything that I worked on. I was afraid that I was going to somehow think that the dialogue in the situations were silly. I don't. I early on this particular gig, I looked around and I saw people like Jeannie and I saw people like Finola, and I watched how they lent a sort of a gravity to it. Yes, this is silly. Of course, it's silly that there's suddenly a cave behind a bookcase that we've established for decades. Whatever the silliness is. But I'm going to lend my authenticity to the situation, and we're going to sell it. And I think the two people I mentioned really demonstrated that they could sell anything. It didn't matter what you wrote for them; they will make you believe it. And I thought, well, that I'm interested in. I'm interested in that. And I feel like once I gave myself over to that, I felt like, you know, I'm part of something bigger than myself, and who could want anything more? I'm there to help this thing, you know, do well. And not only that, you get a chance to go to appearances like this, like we did in Graceland, and you come face to face with people whose lives you are, you know, it's improving. I mean, I'm not saying we're curing cancer, but if he, she enjoys it, then it's my pleasure to bring it to them, you know? And I think at the end of the day, you have done your part to make somebody a little bit happier. So, you know, And I don't want to gloss over the fact that the people that I work with are so terrific. I mean, I'm talking all of them, M, Steve, all of them, John, all of them, you know, just really authentic. Laura, who I've known forever, she's gotten a chance to just show me how she's grown as not only a human being, but as an artist. And it's been a pleasure. I look forward to going in. I really do.
Well, Nina and Valentin are also a back and forth duo on the show. Tell us about working with Michelle and what you think of this couple.
Yeah, Michelle, I fell in love with instantly. And by that, I mean, I just loved her whole energy. She made me laugh the moment I met her. I mean, I think I told you the story before, but I was just there with I was just a sort of mustachioed villain showing up to shoot somebody. And as I thought I was being led away in handcuffs, Frank pulls me over to introduce me to Michelle. And he goes, James, this is Michelle. You're going to do a love scene with her next week, okay? And Michelle looks at me with a smoky look in her eye, and she looks at me, she goes, you're welcome.
Yeah.
And she just made me laugh, and she is, I think, you know, she's probably a rare breed in that she's just a specially superior. I mean, she's gorgeous, but she's also got a very bawdy sense of humor, and she's just a delight. I mean, she makes me laugh so hard, and she gets along great with my wife. And, I think there's a picture at the Christmas party of the three of us together, and it's one of my favorite pictures because the two worlds collide. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that photo too. Another mm-hmm. Leading lady, if you will, of yours on that show is Scarlett Fernandez. I want to hear about, I know there was a time you had to like bribe her with coloring books a little bit to get her to warm up. Tell me about your relationship with her now playing father and daughter.
She really opened up. She really blossomed. Because initially she was very intimidated by me, and that wasn't working. So, you know, I remember when I was a kid doing a TV show with Lauren Green. It's not polite to drop names. You know who told me that? Lauren Green.
We welcome that here, actually.
Yes, totally.
I was a kid on a show with Lauren, and I remember Lauren, I guess he had had grandchildren. He'd worked with so many kids over his career. He realized he needed to grab me and take me out for a chili dog and just really sort of like break the ice. And I kind of did the same thing with Scarlett. You know, I was just constantly bringing her presents and, you know, running around and getting on her level. And she lit up. And I think that's one of the things that you see, and you know, is just sort of a mutual respect. And I think that early on, I made the decision that I wasn't going to talk down, that Valentin wasn't going to talk down to her. If anything, he was going to feel pretty equal emotionally. You know, like she at the end of the day is the most important thing in the world, and he's not much of a disciplinarian. He sees her as an equal emotionally, and I think that comes across. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, James, the last time I talked to you, neither one of us were sure about whether Valentin was deceiving Nina with this whole Sasha thing. We now, of course, know that, she ain't really Nina's daughter. So
brutal.
Totally brutal. So, you know, you playing this guy, needing to justify his behavior, give us your take on this latest, you know, maneuver of Nina by Valentin.
I love it because if I talk to 10 people in the street, 10 out of 10 of them are going to look at me and they're going to say, that's awful. It's so awful. I can't even look at it. And that's true. But, you know, the cool thing about a soap is that it presents these absurd circumstances. And then we as actors, we have to sort of decode it and figure out how to make it. What would this be like if it actually was happening in real life? And Valentin is in his own private hell because he's made a deal with the devil. Because he was so desperate. I don't think he actually thought beyond the end of just getting her back in his bedroom and getting her back in his life. He needed it so badly that he was willing to deceive. And I think at the end of the day, I think, you know, nobody understands better than he does that this is awful. And that he just wishes he could look her in the eyes and have some authenticity. In fact, there's a moment there back after they finally made love again and where he looks at her and he realizes that there's no way he can possibly keep up this charade. And he's about to level with her and let the chips fall where they may. And Lisa ends up showing up and saying, your secret's safe with me, I'll never say anything. And he basically chickens out. He basically decides he's not going to do it. And I think for the last few weeks since, inside, I've been always trying to figure out a way to just kick the can down the road and not want to face the inevitable, that there's going to be a consequence for this. And maybe today won't be the day that the consequence comes. You know, I think unfortunately he's kind of trapped in that mode where he knows he's done something wrong and he wishes he could undo it, but he did what he did to get what he wanted.
Mm-hmm. Tangled webs we weave and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, what'd you hear from the fans in Nashville about Valentin, what they have to say about him?
Well, that's the South, so they're going to be nothing but polite. They might talk a little bit of smack about you once you leave, but they're not going to do it with you in the room.
To your face, they love Valentin.
That's right. No, they that was a good group. You know, it was very, very humbling to be on stage with Maurice and Steve and Finola and Laura. I mean, real soap royalty. You know, and I think that that was just a good group to be on stage with and. I enjoyed that. Steve is I love him. He's a hustler. He knows how to run that room. He does a lot of these with Stone Cold and the Jackal.
Yeah.
It was really it was cool to watch him work it. He could run one of those shows alone. He wouldn't need anybody else. He'd drive the van. He knows how to do it.
I know. No, it really is funny to see him do that because obviously he has to hold back so much of his natural Steve-ness as Jason.
Yeah.
So when you look now, so you've been on GH for a bit, you were on All My Children, you know, how do you characterize the two experiences that you've had so far in daytime?
Well, I take them both equally seriously, but at my age and at my place sort of spiritually and emotionally and in this life, the first time around, I was completely serving myself. I was absolutely doing everything as a sort of a springboard. This time around, I take it just as seriously and I work just as hard, but I'm doing it, I think, to offer up to those around me, to offer to Michelle, to offer to Frank and the producers and the writers. I'm grateful to be allowed to be part of the team. I think that's a shift, but I feel as strongly about Valentin as I did about Will. I loved them both. And I see the intricacies and the nuances of their characters, and I'm delighted for the opportunity to play them.
Well, it's certainly fun to watch, and we thank you for joining us today.
Yes, this was so much fun.
Thank you.
All right, have a good day.
All right, we'll catch you later.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you to James Patrick Stewart for being our guest. Be sure to pick up a new issue on sale now and come back next week for another podcast.